All right, welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us for hour number two here this morning on Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. I'm Tony Beam. I'm Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference and where we are equipping transformational leaders. For the church and society, I serve as Director of Public Policy for the university, along with my colleague, Lisa Van Riper, and I also serve as Director of Public Policy for the South Carolina Baptist Convention. My co-host is Austin Barker.
Morning, everybody.
And we have our special guest on Tuesday here on the phone this morning. Drew McKissick is the head of the Republican Party in South Carolina. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, sir. How are y'all this morning?
Well, we're doing just fine. Just getting back from the long weekend and trying to hit the ground running here this morning. I thought I'd just ask you to give us a little update since we last talked about what's going on in South Carolina in terms of Republican politics. Just kind of give us the overview.
Well, at the top of the list right now, obviously with the legislature coming back shortly here, we'll be dealing with reapportionment, redistricting. That's the usually once every 10-year process. Where legislatures will redraw state House, state Senate, congressional district lines, the numbers that then get made available potentially for everything down to county council, city council, school board lines potentially to be redrawn on the basis of population, from the numbers that they get from the census that's done every 10 years. But, of course, in this cycle, as we've mentioned before, the Biden administration has been extremely slow to provide those numbers, and intentionally so. Normally they come out around, April or May when legislatures are, usually in session. And the slowness has been due to the fact that they would prefer more of the lines around the country to be drawn by federal courts rather than elected legislatures, because most legislatures around the country are controlled by Republicans rather than by Democrats. And so hopefully they're looking to get a better deal out of federal judges if they're still under appeal whenever
right.
election time rolls around next year.
Right.
Hopefully we won't have that problem here, but there'll be lawsuits, I'm sure, but we're hoping that we can get through them quick and have elections on schedule next year.
Right. Has there been any fallout from the Supreme Court, the decision in South Carolina that the Supreme Court said, well, the legislature, when we were talking last week, we talked about the fact, would this be upheld? Provision, provisos in the budget, would they be considered constitutional? They have been. So what
right.
seems to be, are people resigning themselves to the fact now that there can't be mask mandates or vaccine mandates in South Carolina, or is that continuing?
Well, I think resigning themselves might not be the right way to put it, at least for Democrats anyway, because you've got a lot of them who want to make a political issue out of this, quite frankly. Say, for instance, one of the Democrats that's running for governor, Joe Cunningham, the former, failed congressman from the 1st Congressional District, who's one of their candidates for governor, is trying to make an issue out of requiring masks in public schools, et cetera, and was pushing back against the governor and the legislature for, passing the proviso. And the governor expressing support for it. I was trying to make that into a big issue, and they continue to, because, we know their tendencies, and we know, what they like to see, and they like to see more control in the hands of, government vis-a-vis parents, et cetera, making those decisions instead. So really, that's the biggest place where you see that pushback is, organized Democrats, those who are trying to use the issue politically to sort of virtue signal for their own primary voters, for primaries next year. But generally, in terms of the public around the state, it's the law, and it's just going to play itself out at the local level with angry parents if administrators at the school district try to get in the way again.
Something that I was fascinated about over the weekend, I watched a good bit of college football. I watched Clemson and Georgia. I watched North Carolina and Virginia Tech. Watched Florida State and Notre Dame. And, as I was watching these football games, these stadiums are packed with people. And they were side by side, screaming, yelling. I mean, mask wearing was, I mean, even on the sidelines. I mean, I didn't see the coaches wearing masks very much. Occasionally, there'd be a shot of a group of people in the stands, and there might be a third of the people that were in the camera shot that were wearing masks, but the vast majority were packed in there pre-COVID. I thought about how different that looks than the way that the media is portraying the spread of COVID and the Delta variant. I mean, it just seemed like those two things were completely disconnected.
Well, they are. And, you know, of course, and it's disconnected from, or at least the way that they would like to see things, is disconnected from just the reality on the ground of, you know, the percentage of people who have gotten vaccines. And when it comes to children, the percentage of children that one, either actually, you know, get this virus, two, require any serious medical attention if they get this virus, is infinitesimally small and always has been since the beginning. Study after study has shown that. You know, everything that their whole narrative is flies in the face of reality on the ground, as you pointed out. And that, in turn, flies in the face of, you know, where things are going to be politically. You know, people are not minded to continue to have to be told what to do, how to do, to be herded like cattle, so to speak. I mean, you know, we've gone through this for over a year. And, you know, it's like they kept moving the goalposts. Hey, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, you stop the spread, and then we can go back to work. Oh, well, wait, we can't go back to work yet. All right, so we'll start paying people not to work. And, you know, well, we got to wait till we get so many people get the vaccine. And you get the vaccine, you won't have to wear a mask. Well, wait a minute. No, maybe not. We want you to keep wearing the mask. I mean, the CDC and the FDA and the Biden administration have been, like, bouncing in all different directions here. It's like trying to watch a, you know, Chinese table tennis match, you know, on fast forward speed. I mean, it's like you can't follow a bouncing ball.
Right.
And it just doesn't make sense to people.
Yeah. Well, and politically speaking, in South Carolina, back to the politics of it, is it a sound strategy to push the idea of mask mandates and vaccine mandates in South Carolina? Or is that you've observed politics in South Carolina long enough to kind of have a feel for where the majority of people are? Are a majority of people afraid and want these mandates, or a majority of people saying, let people make their own decision about it?
Most people would rather make their own decisions or let other people make their own decisions. But what we're seeing, and you know, you've observed a long time as well,
right?
You know, the Democrat Party, liberalism in general, and the media are generally all of the same mind, sort of yoked at the hip. And the Democrat Party, obviously, is of a different mindset, likes to see more government control. The candidates who are playing to Democrat primary voters, like Joe Cunningham, as I mentioned earlier, Mia McLeod's another one running for governor, and these other ones who may be running for state house, are of that other mindset. And they're playing to their primary voters. They're playing to their liberal base. And it's echoed by the media, because the media is more of that mindset. And, you know, so sometimes it makes the rest of us who are in the vast majority feel like sometimes that we're in a minority until we actually look around, like you said, and we run into other folks like us at a football game or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is reality. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just surprised. I don't know that I expected, after all of the headlines, I expected to see everybody masked up at these events. And even the announcers that were talking about the games were talking about how refreshing it was that football was back and that college football is back and how great it was to see the atmosphere that they were playing in. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out as we go forward. Let me ask you just a question about the Texas law. I was fascinated that over the weekend the Justice Department is trying to say to people in Texas that they're going to protect a woman's right to abortion by going after people who try to prevent women from entering an abortion clinic and from violence against abortion clinics or abortion workers. There's been none of that in Texas. So the Justice Department is essentially saying we're going to enforce a law that is not needed to try to undermine a law that the Supreme Court has said can stay until the constitutionality of it is determined. I just find that to be fascinating.
Exactly. Well, not only that, but just the incredible irony and hypocrisy here that we see with, say, the Biden administration. You know, the day after the Supreme Court, or maybe the day the Supreme Court made that decision, they put out a long statement talking about, and I forget the exact wording, but something to the effect where they were going to put the whole force of the federal government behind defending the right of women, you know, to have an abortion and to defend their rights, as they put it, you know, their rights. We know what that means in quotation marks, down in Texas. Just a day or two after we had women abandoned in Afghanistan to, you know, whatever their fate might be at the hands right. of an obviously anti-women or anti-female rights, you know, regime in Afghanistan.
Right.
Just incredible, you know, hypocrisy of that. But it,
well, and it's, of course, it's what we should expect because we for the left, for progressives, not necessarily, because there used to be members of the Democrat Party who were liberals who were pro-life, and that was acceptable in the Democrat Party. Now, you can't be pro-life. I was reading a story here this morning about the head of some business. See if I can find it right quick. But they actually got fired. They were fired. Oh, yeah. CEO. This is from Daily Wire. CEO of video game developer supported Texas pro-life law. Now he's out from the company. I mean, all he did, he put out, he basically said, proud of hashtag U.S. Supreme Court affirming the Texas law banning abortion for babies with a heartbeat. That's it. His name is John Gibson, CEO of Tripwire Interactive. He tweeted that on Saturday, and he followed up by saying, as an entertainer, I don't get political often, yet with so many vocal peers on the other side of this issue, I felt it was important to go on the record as a pro-life game developer. He was fired. The company issued a statement on Monday saying that he was out effective immediately because, and they even said, because of the comments that he made on Twitter. So here you've got, you can't be pro-life and be liberal or be to the left at all. If you are, then the cancel culture will take you out.
It is, as Rush Limbaugh used to say, a sacrament of liberalism.
Yeah,
you know, to put it that way. I mean, look, and that's a guy that ought to win a lawsuit right there. That guy, you know, from a free speech standpoint, you know, obviously did nothing to disparage his company, didn't disparage anyone with anything that actually didn't used to be supposedly the views of the president of the United States, Joe Biden himself, only a few short years ago, till he had to run for the presidential nomination.
Right. Today on. My names are leaving me all. The briefing with Albert Mueller, he talked about the history. He goes through Biden's pro-life history of over 40 years of being a staunch defender of the right of a baby in the womb. And then, of course, that all changed when he became president of the United States because he's a Democrat. It's incredible.
Drew,
thanks. I really appreciate you being with us today. We look forward to next Tuesday. And God bless you. Have a good week. You know, we're having this conversation with Drew McKissick about how politically is this battle in South Carolina over masking mandates versus personal choice and all that. Fitz News has a column out today, and it begins this way. Government leaders looking to impose mask mandates and vaccine passports in South Carolina in response to the Delta variant of COVID-19 might want to think twice before doing so, especially if they're members of the Republican Party. That's the takeaway from polling data released on Wednesday by Atlanta, Georgia-based strategist Robert Cahaley, a.k.a. The Oracle. According to Cahaley, who serves as the lead strategist for the Trafalgar Group, which is, the Trafalgar Group was a polling operation that predicted Trump's win, I think, in 2016, and then predicted he was going to win again in 2020 because of their methodology. They do a lot more in-depth interviews with the people that they poll to sort of get to the heart of why they're making certain decisions or why they make certain choices. And so some consider the Trafalgar Group's polling to be more accurate. It's all up in the air. But anyway.
Yeah, I would just go back and say that they have, so far, they have a good track record. That's not to say that their methodology couldn't have changed yesterday.
That's true. But according to them, 37.1% of South Carolina voters said that they wanted government to let people proceed at their own risk, making personal decisions about vaccines and masks. In other words, 37.1 say hands off when it gets to the government.
Right.
Less than half that number, 16.2%, said they wanted government to institute mask and vaccine mandates to address the Delta variant.
Okay.
And between those two bookends, 26.2% of respondents said they would prefer government to encourage businesses to mandate masking and or vaccinations, while 19.2% said government should encourage people to get vaccinated and inform them when masking is recommended. So you've got quite a mixed bag here. I mean, you've got there's a plurality that say you can't say majority because it's 37.1%.
Right.
So a plurality say we don't want the government doing anything. And then of those who say they want the government involved, only about 26% say the government should do is encourage businesses or encourage businesses to have mask mandates or even vaccine mandates, but the government shouldn't force those. And 19% say no, the government shouldn't even encourage a vaccine mandate. It should just encourage people to get vaccinated and inform them when masking is recommended. So that's, you know, as far as the politics of this in South Carolina, I don't think that the mandates, It's you're going to have to walk a real tight political tightrope if you're going to be in the position of going out and saying we want mandates. We're the party. If the Democrat Party wants to be the party of mandates in South Carolina, then they're pushing back against a plurality of voters in South Carolina, according to the Trafalgar Group. So.
Those are really, I wrote all those numbers down because those are so interesting to me.
Yeah.
It's particularly interesting to me because they actually were able to do these fine distinctions between groups of people, which I find generally totally missing in the conversation.
From polling.
You know,
it's
I've said it over and over, is that this, most people who are against a mask mandate are portrayed as being against masks.
Right.
That is just not the case. And this study from the Trafalgar Group kind of threads those lines. It draws those lines between different groups of people. I like it.
Now, if you look at GOP primary voters, I mean, they broke it down and looked at that.
Yes.
Okay, because the primary voters are going to pick the candidates, obviously, that are going to run against the Democrats.
Yeah.
So if you look at that, 49% said the government should let people proceed at their own risk, making personal decisions about vaccine and mask. Roughly one-fifth of that total, a meager 10.4% of all Republican primary voters said government should institute mask and vaccine mandates. Among Democrat primary voters, mandates are much more popular. 21.3% of respondents said the government should impose them. Still, a slightly larger number of Democrats, 22.3%, said the government should let people proceed at their own risk. A plurality, and this is interesting, remember, the plurality of voters
was 37.1.
Mm-hmm. A plurality of Democrats, 36.1%, said government should encourage business to mandate masking and or vaccination. So that was the survey was of 1,093 likely 2022 general election voters between August 26th and 28th. The survey has a margin of error of plus or minus 2.97 percentage points. So let's just round that up and say 3 percentage points. Wow.
Yeah, wow is the exact – that, you know, a lot of times when I listen to issue polling, asking people's opinion of an issue, you know, how do you feel about the drawdown in Afghanistan?
Very broadly general question.
It's so easy to get it wrong and very, very difficult to get it right, okay?
Yeah.
Because, for one, asking people about how they feel about an issue is not asking them who they're going to vote for. It just asks them about their feelings. And feelings are so subjective, they can change based on what you had for breakfast this morning, okay? So that is one thing. And then the questions are so often politically loaded. They load up the question on one side side of it. You know, it's like, are you for killing babies or a few, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, we know how you feel about this now.
Right.
So it's hard to get an objective pollster to do a well-phrased question that actually elicits a legitimate response. So issue polling is extremely difficult, but this stuff, these numbers tell me, and especially that they were able to thread those lines so carefully, they tell me that this is pretty good.
Well, it tells me that it's politically dangerous for the Democrat Party if they think that their path to a return to power is going to be along the lines of the government requiring masking and vaccinations, that even people in the Democrat Party are split over this
best. That's it. And that's why I think that's why I like this, is because it basically, the takeaway from this says masking and vaccine mandates, it's complicated.
Yeah,
that's the answer, because that's who I talk to. Listen, my own personal feelings about masking and vaccines are complicated.
Well, and here's the final information from this article. Among all voters, 53.3% of respondents said COVID-19 was significantly affecting their daily decisions. So over half the people said, yeah, it's making a difference about decisions that I make, including 25.3% who said its impact was very significant. Only 23.6 said the virus was only slightly impacting their daily decisions, including 13% who said its impact was very slight, and 20.1% said it was having no impact at all.
What was that last number,
20.1%? 20.1% said no impact whatsoever.
Wow.
I don't make any decisions based on COVID. None that I'm aware of. I mean, the decision to put on a mask when I walk into my office, but that's not my decision. Mm-hmm. That's the decision of North Greenville University, which I respect. So, I mean, I'm fine wearing a mask. They're the proper authority over me. And they're trying their best to take the information that they have to make sure that we don't have a serious outbreak.
I don't always write down numbers like this, man, but these numbers just made me so happy today for some reason. Thanks for staying with us this long, and we're pleased to have on the show with us this morning the chairperson of the South Carolina Democratic Party, Trav Robertson. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. It's good to be with you.
Well,
even though it's on the phone and not in person.
Well, Trav, and we hope there'll be a time you can come join us in person. This is Tony Beams. Good to have you on the show this morning.
Good to hear your voice, Tony. And anytime I can get home to the upstate, I'm willing to do it.
Excellent.
Even if it's by phone. Hey, tell us about that. You're from Anderson, if I'm correct. Is that right?
Yep. Born and raised in Anderson, South Carolina, and graduated from the public schools there. And then my mom taught for a long period in Greenville, as a matter of fact. We've got a lot of dear friends in the education system throughout the upstate, and a lot of friends in general.
Now, you and Dave Wilson did you go to school together? Is that what that connection was like?
Well, you know, Dave is much older than I am, even though he's got all of his hair and looks 20 years younger than I am. But no, when we were at Carolina together, and you know, at that time, broadcast journalism was just starting to take off, and he would run around campus with a television camera, and he was really the one person who went about, you know, with a camera, focusing on all the student activities, and it was really great training for where he is today.
Yeah, I could see that.
Smart human being.
I'm chairman, by the way, of the Palmetto Family Council. And of course, he's the president right now. So you probably knew all that. So anyway,
I did.
Trav, we're kind of limited on time, and so we just have a few minutes. Can I ask you just the first question? Is I'm interested to know how you got involved in politics, particularly in what you're doing now. I assume you know that you have a vision for the state of South Carolina, and you want to see that accomplished through politics, or else you wouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Well, I mean, I'm an accidental party chairman. I never grew up wanting to be a party chairman, and quite frankly, I've spent most of my life running campaigns, and that is how I chose to participate in our social contract. You know, I can remember from a very young age being on my father's shoulders, going into an old mill in Anderson, and him pulling the curtains and him casting his vote. So I was raised by two very civic-minded people. My mother taught school for 48 years, and my dad ran the Anderson-Oconee-Pickens Mental Health Centers prior to that, he was a clinical psychologist. So I grew up in what I like to think of as a servant family, to the extent that my mom and dad, you know, most of your listeners won't know this. I claim that they got their PhD from the New Orleans Theological Baptist Seminary, because dad would go to class and mom would type it. And but, you know, I grew up in a family that was very civic-oriented, but all service-oriented, but also one that read a great deal and wasn't afraid to have discussions about religion and philosophy and the current events of our time.
Trav, let me ask you something about your background. I grew up in North Carolina, and I've talked about this on the show before. My mom and dad were both Democrats, but my mom she would be the poll manager. And I mean, she was always volunteering in the election process, always on the Democrat side. My dad was a Democrat, but he was enthralled or got drawn into Ronald Reagan's 5-minute radio programs and got me listening to him. And that's how I kind of migrated to the Republican Party. Were you raised in a Democrat environment and just stayed there, or where politically did you become a Democrat?
You know, it's first of all funny. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I actually watched, before I went to sleep last night, the Don Rickles roast of Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California last night on the old Dean Martin roast. But you know, my mom and dad, there's no question that my mother and father are Democrats. They were not involved politically because of their jobs. And as a result of that, my mom and dad always gave us the ability. They believed that one of the greatest gifts from God was the ability to rationalize, logically deduce, and think for ourselves. And so they always gave that. That was our decision to make. But, I mean, there's no question that I got that influence from my mother and father.
Yeah.
So I don't know that my sisters are quite that influenced, but there's no question about me.
Tony hates it when I say this, but I hate politics. And I've made no bones about that. But if you ask my kids, I've got 6 kids, and my kids will tell you, Daddy hates politics, but he thinks they're important, and so that's why he doesn't. So
I mean, I think that's most American.
I totally agree. And so I'm interested in your opinion, kind of this, is that, you know, one of the things that I regret the most about politics that just makes it so distasteful to people like me is that they're so hyper-partisan, and people can't just seem to tack to the middle and get along with each other. Now, obviously, there are lots of issues in our politics today that we just can't seem to agree on. So do you have a sense of that? And is that you've been involved in South Carolina politics. Is that as true here as anywhere else? And what's the solution to that for people like me?
Well, I think that you have to remember that, you know, that politics is one of those things that is. It is as old as America. It just may have been under different parties, whether it's the Whig or the Tories or things of that nature. But, you know, someone sent me a text message last night from a former Republican legislator. It says, Trav's one of my best friends. We talk all the time, and that's how politics should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the truth is this, is that we still have to remember one fundamental tenet, and that is that we're all people. You know, Robert Cahaley, who's from Pendleton and from Anderson County, Robert and I are dear friends, and I wouldn't trade that friendship for anything in the world, because politics will come and go, but friendships won't. And, you know, Andy Rooney said one time that, you know, he was lucky to be able to count five fingers his true friends in life, and that stuck with me. I think this is the overarching issue here. Is it used to be that when Reagan attracted Democrats, we could all agree on what the truth was. We could all agree on that we wanted, you know, the American dream. We wanted a house. We wanted a good-paying job. We wanted access to health care, good education, and to be able to take our families on vacation once or twice a year. The fact is that we no longer can agree on what the truth is.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. We used to get disagree on the means by which we got to that truth, or the means by which we accomplished that vision or that goal. And now, instead of disagreeing about the means, we simply disagree about the facts and the truth. And that is a fundamental problem in this country, and I'm not sure I can answer that question.
Well, let me ask you this, Trav, because I was reading, I think it was Atlantic. I try to read from a lot of different sources to figure out, you know, to be able to try to come up with what you're talking about, the truth. But they were talking about, it was a column about the illiberal left is the way that they determined it. So there's a divide in the Democrat Party, it seems, from things that I read, between and we have our divides in the Republican Party as well. But particularly in the Democrat Party right now, between progressives and what you would call traditional classical liberals, and they seem to be pushing back and forth. How are you navigating that as head of the Democrat Party in South Carolina? Are you trying to keep those two sides together? Are you choosing a side? Or what is the path that you see to try to keep the Democrat Party united?
Well, first of all, the Democratic Party is one that is a party that includes everybody. And you know, it goes from those moderate independent Republicans who did not like, a president who cheated on his wife with a porn star, or, you know, those people that supported Bernie Sanders. The fact is that governing is never easy, and neither is the administration of government. And I think that what we have to do is we just have to figure out an idea or a vision for a better America, and maybe disagree on how we get there, but realize we're all trying to get there.
Yes.
And it's not an easy task. I mean, you know, just the other day you saw some of those progressive folks, go out to Jim Clyburn's office, just like you've seen some of the Trump folks go after some of the members of Congress in South Carolina. And
right.
It is one of those interesting things is that, let me put it to you this way. My father said that the difference between people and dogs is that people can rationalize any action or consequence thereof. And the truth is that some people you simply can't rationalize and talk to anymore.
Yeah, well,
and I don't know how we fix that. And I think that that is something that is not just endemic of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
No, that's you're right. It transcends both. Look, we're out of time, but this is a fascinating conversation, and we want to have it again. We want you to feel like you can come on here and we can have these discussions, because I think if we're ever going to get better, it's going to take folks that are willing to talk to each other on different sides of the aisle to be willing to do it.
And that's really something for Tony to say that, because he hasn't talked to a Democrat in 8 years.
Well, that's not true.
Well, I feel honored to be the first.
No, I'm kidding.
Trav, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Take care.
Yep.
All right, we'll be in touch. Take care.
Thanks for listening to us today. We welcome to the show this morning a good friend of Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. This is Congressman Jeff Duncan from the 3rd District here in South Carolina. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Tony and Austin. Great to be on with you this morning.
Always a pleasure. I hope you had a good Labor Day weekend. And I wanted to say to you, the barbecue, I haven't talked to you since the barbecue, but that was a great event. So many people there. And I was really impressed with Governor Kristi Noem. I had never heard her speak before. I'd only read things that she had written, seen her on an interview on Fox News, but really hadn't had the opportunity just to listen to her for the period of time that she had to speak, and was very impressed with her communication style.
Well, exactly. I mean, I was honored that she came. She and I had been friends since we were both elected to Congress in 2010, and I knew her capability, and I've watched her as governor. I think she's doing a great job. We've got a lot of great governors across the state that I served with, Ron DeSantis down in Florida.
Right.
And hopefully Jeff Landry that you heard speak, as well as the attorney general in Louisiana,
right,
will be governor of Louisiana one day. So just a lot of great people out there, and hopefully everyone enjoyed what they were exposed to.
One of the funniest moments to me is Jeff Landry's accent, and then having Governor McMaster come and say, "Finally, somebody I can understand." Yeah, you know, that was just
A lot of people talk about Jeff Landry's Cajun accent, but it adds a lot of flair there.
It does. Well, let me ask you about a couple of things that are happening now. Of course, we've got so many things, obviously, in the news. Afghanistan continues to be a mess, even though the press is now ready to move on. I think they pretty much decided to give the Biden administration heat until Labor Day and then shift focus, which is what the administration is trying to do. And yet there's still at least 100 Americans in Kabul that we know of that are trying to get out of Afghanistan, plus the number of those that helped the United States military during our 20 years there who are also trying to flee for their lives. How do you see all of this, and what do you think that could be done? What can be done now that we don't have anybody on the ground in Afghanistan to help these people?
Well, first off, President Biden has no one to blame but himself for the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. We could have had a contingency force that remained in place. The fact is there are at least 100 and probably more like 500 all over the country, both in Kandahar, Mazar-e Sharif, and Kabul. And other places. These are Americans that were serving our country in some capacity. Then we also have the translators, people that helped the American Army over there fight the Taliban for so many years. That's one of the biggest egregious moments, I think, of the Biden administration, is leaving those people that were allies to Americans over there. And so I don't know what the answer is. I would have done things differently. I believe once we saw the Taliban come into Kabul, I would have brought the 101st Airborne or someone in there and secured the airbase. I never would have given Bagram away in the negotiations and taken the Kabul airport. Bagram was a Air Force base and was highly secured and had a great perimeter and other things. So we've got to try to get the Americans out. Our office has worked with other offices on Capitol Hill to try to get, you know, creative ways to get Americans out. I'm not going over like Mark Wayne Mullen into the country and trying to do it myself, but you know, there are a lot of Americans and a lot of American efforts that are trying to get our people out.
Yeah, and, you know, Mark Wayne Mullen was very vocal over the weekend, upset that the State Department was trying to take credit for something that his group actually accomplished. They were pretty much saying, you know, here's a statement, senior State Department official said on Monday, the U.S. has facilitated the safe departure of four U.S. citizens by overland route from Afghanistan. Embassy staff was present upon their arrival. They didn't want to talk about what country received them, of course, to try to keep that door open for others that would get out. But then, as you mentioned, that it was pushed back very hard by saying that, look, the State Department didn't have anything to do with this, that there were people on the ground risking their life, and the State Department basically didn't do anything until they were out of Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, the lies are very evident, and Darrell Issa is working hard. He's caught the State Department in similar lies as Mark Wayne Mullen has. The State Department is just trying to do damage control because they messed up as well, and advising the Biden administration to withdraw the way they did. We spent over $1 billion on the embassy, the brand-new embassy in Kabul. That's now in Taliban hands. The Taliban flag flies over that building now, not the American flag. So a lot of mistakes happened by the Biden administration, and I'm not happy about it. I've signed articles of impeachment to impeach the president. I think he has failed us as commander-in-chief and failed us as lead diplomat in the negotiations. And, you know, I was supportive of Donald Trump and others that said we should get out of Afghanistan after a 20-year plus war. I'm not for perpetual wars, but there's a right way and a wrong way, and this was a wrong way. This is Biden's Saigon moment, and it's going to haunt him for the remainder of his administration, and I hope that administration is very short.
The Biden administration says now they're going to pivot to domestic affairs now that we're past Labor Day, and they're going to try to put Afghanistan behind them. And they want to talk in their pivot. They're going to focus on getting the $3.5 trillion spending bill that is in the House. They're going to try to get that back over, get it passed through the Senate, and also they're working on this infrastructure bill. How do you see those things playing out politically for the White House going forward?
Well, first off, it's amazing we have Democrats like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema who are standing in the gap for our liberties and holding the line on spending because we lost the Senate and have not taken the House. These bills will be marked up next week. Energy and Commerce Committee that I serve on will have a portion of that markup. It'll last a few days.
on what we have jurisdiction over. The bill will probably pass the House and will die over in the Senate, thank goodness. $3.5 trillion on top of all the COVID and all the other spending that the Biden administration has done just puts us further and further in debt, Tony, and I think that's the biggest national security issue we have is our burgeoning debt. I'm glad to hear you talk about the Biden administration focusing on domestic issues because the economy is terrible. You know, they only added 235,000 jobs in August, and this is when we're also seeing a lot of people come back out of COVID, should have had a lot more jobs added. There are 8.4 million Americans remaining unemployed, but inflation is the issue that they've got to focus on. I mean, car rentals are up 73.5%, gas is up 41.8%, used cars are up 41.78%, hotel costs up 24.1%. You know, bacon is up 11.1%, steaks are up 10.7%. You know, all the things we like, right? Yeah, bacon, fish,
right.
Steaks.
But exactly.
Everybody's feeling in their pocketbook. And this is what you vote for when you vote for progressive policies like this that, you know, that don't lower your taxes, don't help you find a job and keep a job, don't help the businesses keep those jobs on the books, threaten higher taxes. You know, and I haven't even talked about the border crisis, and you and I agree that we ought to expand our legal immigration system, but we're seeing an illegal immigration influx into this country by the hundreds of thousands. And over the course of a four-year Biden administration, how many millions of illegals will now reside in our country? And we only think about the Hispanics, Tony, but there are others, Africans, Asians, and Middle Eastern folks that have come to South America and worked their way up and have come into our country that were not apprehended. We don't know who they are, and they reside in our country illegally. What are their goals? Is
right.
it employment or is it nefarious? I just don't know.
There's a story today at Daily Wire talking about the migrant caravan. Last week we were hearing stories that another migrant caravan was forming in Mexico. And apparently there were about 800 from Central America that were in that caravan. But according to Reuters, now the Mexico National Guard is breaking up that caravan. So it's not going to make it to the United States. Obviously, we've got a tremendous problem at the southern border that's not being addressed. And I don't know that the Biden administration, I think the longer they let that go, the more the American people are going to be frustrated because they're beginning to feel the effects of all these people that are being transported throughout the country.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, apprehensions are up 420% from where they were a year ago. That's just apprehensions. That's not the ones that we allowed to come into the country or that
right.
were made it past the border checkpoints and weren't apprehended. They're now here. So if you think apprehensions are up 420%, the illegal population numbers that have actually made it across our border are probably double that.
Right.
So, you know, we're going to see that influx and that impact in our local communities and our states, and they demand state services, education, and welfare and other things that cost us as taxpayers. And it's going to be going to be detrimental to this country
right.
if we don't get a handle of it on it real quick.
Congressman, thanks for spending some time with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. We'll look forward to our next visit. Until then, we pray the Lord's blessings on you and your family as you serve.
Thank you, Tony.
Yep. Well, that's all the time we got for our show today. But the good news is only 22 hours and we'll be back and we'll do it all over again.
And we're out there all the time.
On the podcast, on platforms, just everywhere. Look for Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. Give us a good review.